World News Today, brought to you by the Avril Corporation, makers of Avril Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
German elite troops have been thrown into the Battle of the Bridgehead below Rome today, and Allied forces have fallen back 2 miles to adjust their lines. American heavy bombers have smashed the German airfields in France for the second day in a row. And on the Russian front, Soviet units are reported nearly 100 miles beyond the pre-war Polish frontier. And now for news of the fighting in the Pacific, brought to you direct from Hawaii, Admiral Radio takes you after a few seconds' pause to CBS Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
The Marshall Islands have not been captured. With the capture of Kwajalein Island and nearby Ipae on the southern corner, and Roy and Namur in the northern corner, our forces now control the entire Kwajalein Atoll. We now have occupied 20 islands in this atoll, and fighting continues. At least 5 other atolls in the Marshalls, although pounded by our planes, are still strong enemy points. They will either have to be captured by assault or left to the Japs until they wither into impotency. I keep thinking of these atolls as in the shape of a baseball diamond about 200 miles between bases. Millie, closest to the Gilberts, is at home plate. Molloy Lap and Wochee at first base. Kwajalein, scene of the present action, at second base. Jolliwood at third base. The other, and if Japs placed their faith in the Gilberts, which they armed, they thought we could never take Tarawa. When we did, they started a frenzied reinforcement of the Marshals with their greatest strength nearest the Gilberts. Our forces bypassed these atoll bases to strike on beyond at Kwajalein in a bold, well-executed stroke. It was, in effect, a sea-going pincers movement, executed somewhat as the Russian land forces have done against the Germans. With the pincers closed on Kwajalein, the other Jap bases at Wochee, Molloy Lap, Jolliwood, and Millie are in the pocket. We now hold bases on both sides of them, and our powerful naval forces are in control of the seas on all sides. What is happening in the Pacific now is what we have all been waiting for these many long months, what the Pacific Command has been preparing for a long time. We tooled up, mounted a mass production military machine in the typical American way, then went in and smashed the Japs at Kwajalein by a combination of great power and skillful adaptation of the fighting machine to the situation, based on knowledge gained in the November action in the Gilberts. The Japs developed their style of fighting. Infiltration, jungle sniping, digging into the earth where it was hard to get at them. All right, our leader said, we will devise our own type of fighting, either to dig them out or to grind them into the earth. At Kwajalein, both quality and quantity did the trick. There may be other bloody beaches, such as at Tarawa, but from here on, it is now a question of when we will attack instead of how. Whatever the future change in our immediate tactics to meet changing situations, the formula for victory is now set. Mass smashing power. Quantity and quality. It's still a long way to Tokyo, but the road begins to look surer. There used to be a sort of onus attached to the expression island hopping. I think we may change that now. We are definitely island hopping on the road to Japan, and jump by jump closer to the ultimate and inevitable great sea battle with the Japanese fleet. When you have the kind of superiority we now have, used as it was at Kwajalein, island hopping can be a very satisfactory method indeed. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral Radio in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Here is a true story of how radio built perhaps in one of Admiral's great plants, saved the life of a flying cadet in California. This potential Jap hunter was in a training plane 3,000 feet in the air when suddenly everything grew dark. So dark he couldn't see the instrument panel in front of him. Then came the awful realization that he was blind. Panic-stricken for a moment, his months of rigorous Air Corps training quickly asserted itself. Feeling for his radio equipment, he cried into the microphone, "I can't see, I've gone blind." His commanding officer from the control tower below heard and began talking to the boy. "If you'll follow my instructions exactly," he said, "we'll get you down okay. Talking in a calm, confident voice, the officer guided the blinded cadet through every phase of flying necessary for landing. Keeping the boy in the air until the field could be cleared, the officer brought him down to a perfect three-point landing. We're glad to report the blindness was only temporary, due simply to nervous tension. Admiral Corporation is proud of the vital part Admiral equipment is playing in eventual victory. Admiral was also proud in pre-war days of its leadership as the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. And when victory is ours and Admiral production facilities can be converted to civilian goods, you'll be happy to say, my radio is an Admiral, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Doug Edwards.
For news of the home front, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Washington. Don Pryor reporting.
The Bataan Relief Organization has called a meeting here in Washington for next Thursday, and representatives are expected from at least 14 states. Their object is to seek ways and means of getting aid to prisoners in the Philippines. The members, about 150,000 of them, are relatives of men who fought out there. Also this week, on Wednesday, the President's War Relief Control Board will meet. Its object is the same, but so far there is no indication here that the stalemate in negotiations with the Japanese for prisoner relief will be broken. On Capitol Hill, the Senate is still in the midst of a tangled legislative snarl on the soldier vote bill. The original states' rights measure, as passed by the House last week, may come up for a vote tomorrow in the Senate. If it passes, it will go to the White House. If it fails, then the Senate will take up the Lucas Green federal ballot bill, or it may wind up with a compromise of some kind. Most legislators are getting pretty tired of the argument. Besides, they're anxious to get on with other important pieces of legislation that have been laid aside during the soldier vote debate. One of these is a new tax bill. Chairman Doten of the House Ways and Means Committee and Chairman George of the Senate Finance Committee agree that it might go to the White House by tomorrow night. The bill has been in conference and is all ready for final action. Sometime this week, Congress probably will take up the old but still urgent problem of subsidies. Some kind of action is called for soon. Otherwise, the Commodity Credit Corporation, which conducts the subsidy program, will go out of existence on February 17th. I return you to Admiral Radio in New York.
That's the news from America's home scene. The Germans continue to throw reinforcements into the two furious battles now going on across the Atlantic in Italy. For a direct report on the latest developments in the Mediterranean war zone, Admiral Radio takes you after a brief pause to CBS Algiers. Winston Burdett reporting.
While bitter seesaw fighting continues on our beachhead south of Rome, the Germans are bringing fresh reinforcements into Cassino to stiffen their house-by-house resistance in that key stronghold of the main Fifth Army front. This afternoon, CBS correspondent Farnsworth Fowle watched the battle for Cassino from a rocky vantage point overlooking the Rapido and Garigliano rivers. Inside the town, Fowle says, our tank and infantry teams have dug the Germans out of a few more houses since yesterday. Both inside and out, an earth-shaking artillery duel was raging this afternoon. Our shells were whistling into the central and southern part of Cassino. They were aiming at German batteries in the hills west of the Garigliano. Already, they were reaching out to blast the next important road junction westward up the Liri Valley. Their main target was a rocky knoll rising a couple of hundred feet behind Cassino with a medieval castle on top. Last night, our infantry attacked that knoll, but were driven back by German units holding on behind the heavy castle walls with plenty of small arms. Shortly after noon today, Fowle says, we tried again. Everything landed on the castle all at once. A concentrated barrage of more than 100 field guns, including some of very heavy caliber. When the barrage was over, the castle tower was still standing. And later this afternoon, our infantry was attacking again. Our troops are meeting the same ferocious resistance in the hills north of Cassino, where the enemy is counterattacking often and heavily. To the south of Rome, we are still holding on to the perimeter defenses of our beachhead. The German force there is several divisions strong and includes some crack SS troops, the first we have met in the line in Italy. Fowle reports that the Germans have at least 8 divisions divided between the beachhead and the Cassino sector alone. The news today is that the Germans are hitting back heavily with almost everything they have in those two sectors. And now back to CBS in New York.
American bombers today struck another heavy blow at German airfields in France. For this news and other developments, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS London, Larry Lesser reporting.
Today, our American heavy bombers flying from this island made their ninth bombing mission in 10 days to plaster German airfields in northern France. It often seems as though the young men of each nation were pitted against each other to decide the fate of the future world. But tonight, you'll hear from a gray-haired man of 69. Yes, almost 70. And he's just been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for his part in operations of the Royal Air Force against the enemy. As gunner and observer, Wing Commander Lionel Cohen has bombed German U-boats, attacked the Gneisenau and Scharnhorst at Brest, and patrolled the Atlantic from Norway to Spain. That would be remarkable enough for a young man, but Lionel Cohen fought his first battle when Queen Victoria ruled Britain. This veteran of four wars has seen as much war as any man alive today. Wing Commander Cohen, what's been your narrowest shave in World War II?
I'm not sure, but I think it was the time I was in the Hudson, off Norway. We were looking for a German battleship. We were cruising off the Norwegian coast when we were sighted by Messerschmitts and fired on by flag ships.
It was our duty
to avoid combat, and my pilot took such violent evasive action that I was thrown around the plane. We got away with it, but I was pretty well knocked about, and I felt it for the next 5 weeks.
Well, Wing Commander Cohen, can you tell us something about your first war, the one against the Malabeli natives in East Africa back in 1893?
Well, I was a very young lad, a trooper. We used different weapons in those days. Mine was a Snyder rifle with brown paper cartridges.
Well, what about your experiences in World War I?
Well, after serving in the Boer War, I settled down in Africa as a planter and subsequently became a miner. I left the mines to fight the Hun in East Africa. Then I was attached to the Royal Naval Air Service as an observer. We used to fly some queer-looking kites in those days. It was quite a business, dropping arrows on the Germans and seeing them run to cover.
I guess it must have been. It must be quite a change to go out now in a B-24 Liberator bristling with machine guns and depth charges, sir.
Yes, I've flown in modern planes over the seas of Norway, Holland, Denmark, Iceland, France, and the Mediterranean. I remember one flight with one of the bravest men I've ever known, an Australian pilot, Barkley. We sighted a U-boat on the surface and went down to 300 feet after it. A shell went right through our Sunderland. That didn't deter him. We finally disabled the U-boat.
Well, Wing Commander Cohen, what do you think of the boys flying in this war?
I'd like to say they are the grandest and most intelligent lads I've ever known. America, Britain, and the Dominion should be proud of them after this war.
Well, thank you very much, Wing Commander. We return you now to New York.
For a summary of the latest developments on the Russian front, here in our New York studio is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
Very likely we shall have to wait until after the war, perhaps until two or three German leaders, such as may survive the coming debacle, have written their memoirs. Before we shall know the reasons why the Germans have run the very grave military risk of leaving their troops so long in the Dnieper Bend area in South Russia. Certainly they are paying a very heavy price for doing so. And it's impossible to believe that the German General Staff has not again and again bitterly protested against the taking of such chances. Now a considerable German force is surrounded on the Dnieper River between Kiev and Cherkasy. This force is in process of being slowly cut to pieces, under orders, according to prisoners, to resist to the last. Though the trapped Germans probably do not amount to the total suggested by some headlines, this is a heavy loss to the Germans. And just a few moments ago, a Russian special communique came through announcing that the Russians have broken the lines which the Germans have so long held between Nikopol, down on the lower Dnieper, and the iron center of Kryvyi Rog. The Russians have captured the important rail junction of Apostolovo. This breakthrough threatens the entrapment of the Germans in Nikopol itself and those in Kherson, the seaport at the mouth of the river. It certainly means that the Germans in all this area must retire behind the Bug River, probably a process which has long been going on bit by bit as opportunity permitted. But the point is that the Germans, if operating on strictly military considerations, should have been back behind the Bug long ago. There is no military justification for the risks they have assumed. Therefore, the conclusion is inescapable that they are motivated by political considerations, probably a Hitler fixation against allowing the Russians to reach the Romanian frontier and thus begin the Russian penetration of the Balkans. For this, as for others of his alleged inspirations, the Führer seems likely to have to pay a heavy price, or rather the soldiers of his armies on the Russian front are paying the price now, which he will have to pay in person later on.
Landing craft are becoming increasingly important weapons in Allied war plans. For a report on the Navy's landing craft training program, Admiral Radio takes you to an amphibious training base along the Atlantic coast. Bill Slocum, Jr., reporting.
Here on the bleak and choppy waters of Chesapeake Bay, it ain't fitting weather for man nor beast, nor for that strange combination of both, the radio announcer. That means it's perfect weather for the project at hand, a landing operation. I am standing in the prow of a landing craft. There are almost a dozen different kinds of landing boats and ships. Some carry tanks, others infantrymen, others ammunition, and trucks and so on. They each have the same basic design, and that design seems to have been stolen from the family bathtub. The landing craft I'm on is the apex of a V, sweeping toward the beach. There are four boats on each side of us. We're the first wave, carrying mostly infantrymen. Behind us is another wave, and then behind that is the third wave, which is the Navy Beach Party, the group that keeps things running smoothly on shore as the Army goes about the job of winning the beach. There's nothing ahead of us save a beach, which we know is heavily mined, dynamite mines too, practice or no practice, and a couple of speedy little landing craft laying down a smoke screen. The smoke is drifting into our boat now, and if we survive its frightful odor, the dynamite should be easy. Crouched at my feet are 30-odd infantrymen. Armed to the teeth and already masters of the first law of landing operations, keep your head down. It's hard to see the beach from here, but it can't be far, and when we do run into it, the whole nose of this boat will suddenly change from a prow to a ramp. The boys scoot the length of the ramp, jump into chest-deep water, and wade ashore. As the boat beach looms out of the smoke and the fog, the commander of the infantrymen snaps out a few orders to his men. Keep your head down. Keep your rifles dry. Keep moving. On a ramp in the stern, Navy men steer this landing craft straight for a spot long ago determined in pre-invasion planning. The mines will be popping soon. They are carefully placed to avoid injury to the men, but their purpose is obvious. Landing operations are noisy, and now is the time for the soldiers to get used to it. Aircraft, hostile aircraft, was supposed to fly overhead. Possibly you can hear it now. Ah, there's the end of the road. The boat scrapes along. Now the ramp will start to go down like a small steel moat bridge. She goes down fast because the boat is a sitting target in this position. There, they're about to bring the ramp down now. Perhaps you can hear it. There goes the ramp. As they go in, landmines blow sand 100 feet into the air, and water mines set off geysers all around us. This is wet and unpleasant work, but the Amphibious Training Command knows that mistakes made here are painful and damp. The same mistakes elsewhere might be fatal. So the command sees to it that the mistakes are made off the shores of Virginia, Maryland, and Florida, which seems a very bright idea indeed. And now, back to Admiral Radio in New York.
For an interview with the commander of a torpedo bomber squadron on the USS Saratoga, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
You've heard the latest news of our advance in the Marshall Islands. Here's Lieutenant Commander Robert F. Farrington, USN, who came back from that battle theater just a short while ago. He was commanding officer of the torpedo bomber squadron on board the aircraft carrier Saratoga, and he's the first pilot from that famous ship's company to appear on the radio since he took part in the action that led up to this latest great attack.
But I wish I weren't. I hope, although I don't know, that the Sarah is right out there in the middle of the Marshal's affair, and I'd much rather be there with her.
Well, how long were you on the Saratoga, Commander?
Quite a while, and we all became very fond of the old ship. She was 16 years old just the other day, but in spite of her age, she's a great ship, and she carries a heavy punch. We nicknamed her the Sarah Cobra.
Well, from your experience, Commander, can you throw any light on the current situation in the Pacific?
It's pretty clear if you look at the map. First of all, we had to knock out Rabaul as a naval base in the northern Solomons. That was a second truck which made it possible for the Jap fleet to operate right down in Australia's front yard and to threaten our whole supply system in the South and Southwest Pacific. When that was accomplished, the enemy had to withdraw his warships to truck, and it lengthened his supply line to the Solomons and New Guinea by about 800 miles.
You took part in that job, didn't you?
Yes, that was the Saratoga's first big assignment, except for an attack on Jap airfields at Bonus and Buka on the northern coast of Bougainville. That was my squadron's first raid. We were part of an air group that knocked out those fields in preparation for the landings on Bougainville. The Rabaul raid came later. We went in with a smaller converted carrier and sank or damaged almost every ship in the harbor. That's the raid that eliminated Rabaul as a naval Japanese naval base. We went back again about a week later, but there was hardly a ship left.
The opposition at Rabaul was pretty heavy, wasn't it?
They sent out about everything they had, between 75 and 100 Zeros. But our fighters under Commander Joe Clifton did a wonderful job. Their instructions were to stick with the dive bombers and torpedo bombers, to get us into the target and back to the ships, and they did. We only lost one plane. Altogether, we got 23 Japs, definitely, and 24 probables. And if our fighters hadn't been fighting defensively to guard us, they probably would have shot down more than that.
Well, that's a pretty impressive victory anyway.
Well, it certainly proved the superiority of our planes, equipment, and pilots. The fact that we could pick all major targets in a well-protected harbor like Rabaul and score hits on virtually every one of them also demonstrates the effective initiative of our pilots. Really, the pilots we're getting now are excellently trained and equipped to do the job that's required in actual combat. That applies also to the enlisted air gunners and radiomen who fly with our Navy pilots.
Well, we were looking at the map just a moment ago, Commander.
Oh, yes. Well, after Rabaul was knocked out as a naval base, it was necessary to attack the Gilberts and Marshalls. You know the story on that.
Yes, I think we all know the story on that. Lieutenant Commander Farrington, incidentally, has been awarded the Navy Cross on two occasions. Before his assignment to the Saratoga, he took part in the Battle of the Coral Sea. I return you now to Admiral Radio in New York.
There's this news from the Southwest Pacific today. We've destroyed another 20 to 26 Jap planes in new raids on Rabaul, New Britain, and Wewak, New Guinea. We dropped more than 100 tons of explosives on Wewak, where in the past 2 days, 300 tons of bombs have raised havoc with 4 airfields and destroyed 87 enemy planes. In the latest attack, our plane started fires visible for 50 miles. Now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Have you written for your Admiral home checkup chart? Thousands of listeners have, and their reactions to its usefulness have been very gratifying to Admiral Corporation and Admiral dealers. This pocket-sized chart contains much valuable information for making a checkup at home when your set doesn't operate perfectly. There are no strings attached to your getting a copy. All you do is write to Admiral Radio in care of this station and ask for it. Or you can pick one up from your Admiral dealer. Here is a typical suggestion made in the chart. All wires must be firmly connected. Don't merely twist your ground wire around a water pipe or radiator. Use a ground clamp. Please understand that the Admiral checkup chart will not supplant the experienced repair service offered by your Admiral dealer. By making a checkup at home, however, it may eliminate wasting your dealer's valuable time on a needless service call. So write for your Admiral home checkup chart today. There is no cost or obligation. It's just another friendly service from Admiral Radio. Simply address a card or letter to Admiral Radio in care of the station to which you are listening. The appearance of service personnel on this program does not constitute an endorsement of the product advertised. Despite the spectacular progress of America's huge synthetic rubber program, we still face a critical shortage of tires for civilian use. Immense military demands for tires and other rubber products, plus manpower shortages, make it impossible to meet normal civilian requirements, much less the huge backlog of demand that has accumulated over the past 2 years. The only answer to this tire shortage is strict conservation. Every car owner is urged to conserve his present tires to the utmost and to have them recapped as soon as they need it. America's rubber-borne transport must be kept rolling. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.